Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Christy, today we're going to be having a conversation with a general surgeon, Dr. Paul Ruggieri, about his new book, Confessions of a Surgeon. All kinds of religious and spiritual and medical implications. I think this is going to be interesting.
An interesting book. Looking forward to that conversation. But first, we've got some research that matters about...
On surgery.
On surgery robots, on medications...
Not surgery on robots.
No.
Robotic
using robots
surgery,
in surgery.
Which is something that's really relatively new and spreading like wildfire. And I guess I'm really glad to see this research that says... Does it make a difference?
Well, I mean, it is certainly the hot thing to do is be trained and be an expert in using robots in surgery. And I think the thinking is that robots might make fewer mistakes or might be more reliable than humans in some of the steps. But it costs a lot more than a low-tech approach, for sure. So the question is it better?
Right. And earlier this year, there was research about men with prostate cancer, and was there a decrease in complications with the robotic surgery, which is what I think people would hope, and there was not. And this particular paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology looked at women with endometrial cancer who underwent robotic surgery.
And I mean, endometrial cancer, a big deal. More than 40,000 women get this diagnosis in our country every year. And in this, for the treatment of a hysterectomy or removing the uterus, they had 60% of women in the study who had a robotic surgery, where the surgeon sits at a console and operates the robotic arms that take the uterus out of someone's belly.
As compared to what we would think of as a laparoscopic surgery, where the surgeon is working with instruments in the operating room there.
And in this study, it's another study that shows that the cost was much higher using the robots, but the bottom line benefit to the patient was no different. So everyone, in terms of complications, the complication rate was the same.
And so I think a take-home point here, at least until there's more research or research at all, really, from a randomized controlled trial, a gold standard, is that robotic surgery for many conditions right now doesn't necessarily offer more benefits. And so don't feel like you're maybe getting second-class care. You should be with a good surgeon who really has done whatever procedure you're having lots of times. And I'm sure we can talk about this today with our guest.
We sure can. But first, we're going to talk, our next research is about those medicine statins. So, Adam, if I had high cholesterol, would you prescribe me a statin?
Well, Christy, for you, it depends. I would have to find out what your perhaps your risk of underlying heart disease. We know women have lower risk than men, and you're not a smoker, you're not overweight. But the question of this research is, would I deny you the opportunity to get the benefits from statins because maybe I think that your risk maybe isn't as high as I would have thought.
Yeah, and so there could be a bias that that doctors think that these medicines work better for men, or the bias could be about the fact that men in general have higher risk than women. This is a study looking at 18 different clinical trials, so one of those systematic reviews, finding that statins cut the risk of heart attack, stroke, and death to a similar degree in women as it does in men.
Yeah, almost 20% in women risk reduction. This article in 140,000 plus patients in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. You know, Christy, I should at least offer you the option if your cholesterol was high or there are other reasons that you would benefit from a statin and talk with you about that there are benefits and maybe you would benefit or not, but I should have that conversation.
That's a good answer, Adam. Thank you for treating me appropriately.
We'll talk later.
My cholesterol's not high, but
what about our very next research that matters?
Okay.
What do I say to my son who, when he goes snowboarding, seems to fall a lot more than when he skis.
Well, you know, this surprised me, but not so much, because I tried snowboarding once. So this is, you know,
we have video of that.
I couldn't walk for days afterwards. I seriously think I broke my tailbone, but because I fell so much. And this was a study done in Vermont at a ski resort looking at over 12,000 injuries over 18 winter seasons, finding that most injuries happen in young, inexperienced female snowboarders.
So I guess that was you, Christy.
I read that. I was like, oh.
How did they know about this? Maybe they have a video. But this was in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. And there is something important here, which is that, you know, when you go to water ski and you learn to water ski, you learn to water ski on two skis before you really get up to learning to one ski, because the balance issue is a factor here. And there potentially are more injuries that come about from snowboarding. So I think as a parent, having the conversation and being sure that your loved one, your child, or you really has more experience with this before one advances perhaps and does things that could cause more injuries.
Sure. And it is not the same as skiing. Snowboarding is definitely requires very different skills.
It looks really fun, but you know, you can get going really fast. It's not so easy to stop.
Well, your feet are strapped down. You can't get your balance. So
well,
anyway,
perhaps,
it's hard.
Perhaps with global warming there right now, they're having some problems in skiing in lots of places.
Unfortunately. Okay, the last one is about prostate cancer and fertility. So this is a study looking at those radioactive seeds that are sometimes used to treat early prostate cancer, to see what that does to the DNA in a man's sperm.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of Urology. And the question really comes up, should men who are undergoing the seed therapy for prostate cancer, if they're young, should they actually bank their sperm because perhaps the seed therapy will make them infertile?
Granted, there are not very many of my patients who have prostate cancer who are still planning on having children. But for people who are, I mean, this is an important conversation to have. If you have prostate cancer and you are seriously thinking you would want more children in the future, then you should have this conversation with your physician before undergoing the treatment.
Now, we should say that this study was actually done on 5 men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very limited study for a very limited population. But
it's not really a surprise.
It's not really a surprise. You know, hopefully, if whatever type, and we've had some conversations with guests about cancer care, this just adds to one of the things, I think, for providers and maybe some patients to be aware of.
So we've had research on prostate cancer and fertility, on using robots in surgery.
About Christy's injuries from snowboarding.
And about statins working as well for women as they do for men. Hopefully that research is helpful. That concludes the research portion of our show.
We'll take a short break, Christy. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Ruggieri about his book, Confessions of a Surgeon. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with General Surgeon and Fellow of the American College of Surgeons, Dr. Paul Ruggieri, about his book, Confessions of a Surgeon.
And we want to welcome Dr. Ruggieri to Your Health. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
You know, I think it's unusual that we have a surgeon on the show coming in to talk about a book called Confessions of a Surgeon. That in of itself would have gotten you on our show, but the subject of your book is very thoughtful. Tell us how you came about to think about writing a book.
Well, I've been wanting to write a book like this for about 8 years. Actually, it started about 8 years ago in a little different shape and form and kind of evolved into this. But I've been wanting to really write a book for me, for the public, to really kind of let them know what I'm thinking, what surgeons are thinking in the operating room, bring them right into the operating room in the middle of the night in intense situations.
Why? Why is that? Because
I think an educated patient is the best patient you can have. And I make suggestions in that book on two patients on what to ask their surgeon or how to find a decent surgeon in your town. I think patients need to ask questions, need to be involved in their care. They really have to be active in finding out who their surgeon is.
So this was
what the experience of their surgeon is.
A combination of your own confessions and experience and being able to share that and get it out with really teaching the patients.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Well, I'm just thinking it sounds like it was a combination of your needing to tell. I mean, the experiences that you've had as a surgeon are profound.
Yes, and you're right, exactly right. It is a combination. That's exactly right.
And tell us a little bit about your background. How did you make a path into surgery? And what are one or two pivotal experiences that influenced who you ultimately became as a surgeon?
Well, I come from a middle-class background up in the Northeast. I worked my way through college, medical school. I took out loans, went into the military to pay for medical school, owed some time for them. And I've always wanted to be, I always wanted to go into medicine. And when I got into medicine, I knew I was going to be a surgeon.
Why a surgeon?
Well, the main reason is that I wanted to do something right away to impact people's lives. And in medical school, obviously, you get exposed to different subspecialties. And I always thought the surgical residents, first of all, were really cool people. And and what they did was amazing in the operating room. As a medical student,
that's true.
Really
that's amazing. True, by the way. You are cool people, and what you do is amazing.
Well, and you can fix things. I can see how you wanted to. It sounds like the temptation or the desire to want to actually do something.
Yes. Most surgeons have a certain personality. You probably know many surgeons. And they have a certain personality, and most of us want to do something. We want to do things. We don't have much. We don't have a whole lot of patience for other things, in the sense that we really want to be active in what we do. And I think a lot of us went into surgery because we want to do things with our hands. We want to impact people's lives right away. We want to be the one in control. I mean, we want to be the one in control.
So describe a couple of the joys that really come to mind about being a surgeon.
Well, there are many, just like there are bad moments. I think some of the particular joys, there's a story in my book about a woman I saw late one night, a healthy elderly woman who came down with C. difficile colitis.
Which is an infectious toxin cause of diarrhea.
Correct. And she was doing fine. A couple of days before she came into the emergency room, was very healthy, enjoying life with her family, and basically decompensated very quickly. And I had to make a decision whether to operate on this woman or wait another 24 hours. And I decided to operate on her. I had to take out her entire colon, and she actually walked out of the hospital. She was on death's door. And to see situations like that, it is no greater joy.
Well, you talk about obviously many, many things in the book, and we want to really hear some of those stories because I found it really fascinating. But one of the things you mention in your book is that this book is about a love letter to your patients. What do you mean?
Well, it is in a way that I really am expressing my feelings to my patients on so many different levels. I mean, the way I practice, I'm very honest with my patients. First of all, I tell them really what their expectations are, and when something goes wrong, I'm very honest with them. And the book expresses my emotions to my patients on a variety of levels.
Well, in thinking about that, how do you, as a surgeon, temper that emotion of caring for your patients, but also really needing to control that emotion to some degree to get through a difficult surgery?
Well, that's a good question. Everybody has their own way of dealing with situations like that. I mean, most of us, when we're in the operating room, things are very boring most of the time, and they go very well, and we all like that. But when they don't, and there's tense situations, you got to focus. You just have to focus on what you're doing. And afterwards, you really, you know, as a physician, you want to become emotionally involved, but you can't become too emotionally involved because you have to stay above it. Even when you lose somebody, you know, the next day you wake up, you have to go to work. There are other people waiting for you to take care of them. So everybody has their own way of dealing with it.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Ruggieri about his new book, Confessions of a Surgeon. And Dr. Ruggieri, you mentioned in your book a poignant episode about having to be called down on an emergency basis to a young child who ends up dying and sounds like may have been murdered by a parent. Talk a little bit about this loss that surgeons experience, this loss for patients that you hope to have saved, and it happened so quickly.
It did happen very quickly. It was the middle of the morning. I remember this as it was yesterday, and this happened a while ago. I was called down to the emergency room. They were bringing a child in, and nobody really knew what had happened. He was flatlined, basically, when he came in. And I just happened to be very close to the emergency room at the time and came in, and they were doing CPR. And, again, no one knew what had happened. So we were trying to figure out what is going on with this child. And then I realized, I mean, the seconds seemed like minutes, but it didn't take that long, that he had a small cut under his breastbone. And then someone had said something about an accident at home. And then given his clinical situation, I kind of figured out it was tamponade from some sharp instrument.
That his heart is bleeding, and yet it can't expand.
Correct. He had bled into the sac around his heart and basically choked it off. And I don't know what the exact circumstances were.
But you had to immediately, and you describe in simple but graphic details the most... even to a family doctor, another doctor, a very brutal procedure where you have to cut and into the chest and blood and bleeding and trying to fix things, and the patient didn't survive.
No, it is brutal in one sense, but in the other sense, it's the only option that this child has or had, and that was the only way potentially to bring him back was to get in there, plug up a hole with something, usually a catheter of some kind you put in there, or sew it up quickly and do defibrillation, intracardiac defibrillation. That's his only hope. It's a slim hope, but it's the only hope. In situations like that, that's the patient's only hope. And people are brought back from this sometimes.
Well, and the one thing that I appreciate is that you, in this book, you begin to, we see you as human because you acknowledge that it's not easy to watch this patient not live, and you're putting that out there. Is that an easy thing for surgeons to do, to talk about something like this?
I don't think it's easy to talk about. I think most of us go through different emotions, and many times we bury those emotions. We compartmentalize. We put them away somewhere, especially in crisis situations. But at the end of this particular instance, I had to sew his chest back up, and I was the only one in the room. I mean, I opened it up, so it was my job to sew it up, even though we worked on it for about an hour, and we couldn't bring it back. But somebody had to sew him back up, and I did. And then, you know, you're in there sewing him back up, and there's no one around you looking at him. And you know, that's when you start thinking about life and your own mortality and who knows what else.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but I hope when we come back, we'll follow up on this concept, Are Surgeons Human, as the title of your second chapter, which really raises, you know, a lot of interesting questions. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Paul Ruggieri, about his book, Confessions of a Surgeon. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with general surgeon and fellow of the American College of Surgeons, Dr. Paul Ruggieri, about his new book, Confessions of a Surgeon, The Good, the Bad, and the Complicated Life Behind the OR Doors. And Dr. Ruggieri, tell us a little bit about this kind of code of silence in healthcare, and your book is entitled Confessions. That clearly is about breaking a code of silence. What's the code of silence about, and what do you hope to achieve by writing a book that tells stories?
Well, it's a term I use to describe a culture, I think, that's been prevalent in our profession for a very long time. It's a culture that, docs are very reluctant to speak up about other doctors, particularly surgeons. It's much better today than what it was 20, 25 years ago. But I relate several stories to that culture, and I believe a lot of us just don't want to draw attention to ourselves by speaking up against something that we think is wrong.
Like what?
For instance, the story in my book about a surgeon in a community that basically was not up to par, and everybody knew it, and I was in a position to draw attention to the situation, and I did, and believe me, I was very reluctant to do it, because I am in private practice, and there can be ramifications of that, and there was.
But there are ramifications clearly about letting a surgeon or any doctor who's impaired do something that could hurt people, and I think you.
Of course.
So
exactly
you deserve
right.
commendation for bringing that up and taking that on.
Well, in retrospect, yeah, it's nice to say that, but at the time, I mean, I had my support, but it was a unique situation for me. I had no experience in it. I had no point of reference, and many times surgeons don't think anything will get done, and you just put yourself out there for no reason.
Well, and what about silence or openness about talking about mistakes? I mean, as human beings, we make mistakes, and even in a perfectly controlled environment, as best as it can be in surgery, I'm sure there are mistakes. We know this. Is there a culture of being able to talk about that with patients and with colleagues?
I think there is. I think it's better today. I think for a very long time, it was never talked about, and it's still difficult for me personally, to admit to a patient and a family that that something happened in the operating room that was not correct. I mean, I do it. I that's the way I want to live my life, but it's still not easy to do. I think there's still a culture. Part of it is the legal climate that hovers over us. I think that's part of why the culture still exists. As far as admitting our mistakes, saying we're sorry, but I think it's much better today, and I think more physicians, more surgeons particularly, are establishing a good dialogue with their patients good enough that they can sit down and say, listen, hey, this is what happened. It didn't go well, but this is what I'm going to do.
Well, speaking of culture, you as a surgeon were exposed to very difficult training conditions where you work days probably with very little rest. Today, it's a different situation with the training of surgeons, and Christy's our residency director for family doctors. We know there's work hour reforms that limit the number of hours that are worked. How do you see this transformation? Because you're on the front lines of knowing maybe the good and the bad and the complicated, as you say, of this sort of issue.
Yes, it's interesting. Where I trained, my chairman came from Duke University, and there was a very old school of training there, and he brought that with him, which was fine. I mean, I knew that going into it, but I didn't train that long ago, and it seemed like decades ago. The difference is now with the work role restriction. There is a big difference. I mean, back when I trained, we could have worked until you dropped or somebody told you to leave the hospital, and we did that for several reasons. We wanted to be there. We wanted to be involved with patient care till the end. It's more of a survival contest, really. Today, it's very different with the work rule restriction. And that, has led to some questions about the training of surgical residents today.
Like what?
Some of it. Oh, go ahead. You tell us. I have some theories and what I've heard, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about the impacts, both with numbers of surgeries done in residency and the ability to follow a patient over time.
Yes. I mean, there have been some study. I think the jury's still out because these work rule restrictions came into effect in surgery in 2003. I think we need a little more time to really see what impact they're going to have. But the questions have been raised at the highest level of the American College of Surgeons about the education these residents are getting, the exposure they're getting. Are they getting enough cases to feel comfortable leaving residency, to feel you're comfortable operating independently. What an interesting statistic I saw, about 80 to 85% of chief residents finishing today are doing fellowships in advanced training, whatever they decide to do. Now, why are they doing that? You can theorize on why they may be doing that. But that's one of the worries of the surgical educators in this country.
I wonder, too, is there a difference between, you know, real life as a surgeon, where many people may be working more hours than people are permitted to do during residency, and is that good or bad?
Well, there is a difference. I mean, I'm a private practice surgeon. When I'm on call, I go in. There's no one to take my place. I mean, when I go past 80 hours, I don't go home. But there is a big difference, and actually that's being really discussed now. I mean, residents are coming out of training with this certain type of work hour mentality. However, when they get in a community, when they're on call with a couple of other surgeons, there are no work restrictions. If you're on call, you have to come in and deal with emergencies.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Ruggieri about his new book, Confessions of a Surgeon. And Dr. Ruggieri, you mentioned earlier that you have talk about in your book some important questions for listeners, like how to find a good surgeon. I get asked this about trying to find a good family doctor. How do you answer that question? And what are some questions that people really should be asking their surgeons before surgery?
I think the first place to start is the doctor who's referring you to a surgeon, whether it's an internist or a gastroenterologist. I would ask that doctor, why are you sending me to Dr. X? What's your experience with that surgeon? Have you had a history with that surgeon? Has the surgeon done a lot of these operations? I mean, that's where you could start, because many patients that come to me, they'll never ask any questions of their referring doctor, and many times they don't even know why they're sitting in my office. I kind of have to explain to them. But that's the good place to start. And then you can actually, in the community that you live or the hospital that you're going to get operated on, it'd be nice to know someone inside the hospital, an operating room person, or someone who works there, get an idea of the experience of that particular surgeon that you're going to see. And when you get to the office, you could ask several questions. One is, you know, how many of these operations have you done in the last month or the last 6 months or the last year? Is this something you do commonly or practice? If it's not, then why not? What are the complications rates that you have with this particular operation? Whatever operation you're going to have, what's the main complication and how often has it happened to you? Because every one of us has complications. I mean, we can do the same operation 100 times. The 101st time, we will get a major complication. But that's okay. Then you just have to deal with it when you realize it and fix the problem. But there are several other questions that you can ask patients. Patients can ask their surgeons. Patients are afraid to ask surgeons questions.
Well, and I think asking them to talk with their primary care doctor, and a lot of my patients ask me, as their family doctor, who I recommend or what to expect. And a lot of what I know, too, is how well the surgeon communicates with me as a primary care physician, his recommendations or her recommendations, communicates back what to expect and what sort of follow-up or items are needed. And that collaboration is a big part, and, you know, that does affect outcomes as well.
It does. And what do you really know about the surgeons you refer to?
Well, and that's the interesting thing, is that I can't say the way the operating tech can and the staff that's in the OR, how, you know, skilled this person is with their hands. You know, we can look at data and know reputations of people and their research, but it's the people in that OR and in the operating room who really know how this surgeon interacts in a way that, we always can't always have that level of insight.
True. I mean, the bottom line is patients are really limited to what they can find out about the experience of their surgeon.
Well, Dr. Ruggieri, we have to wrap up. Just one last question for you.
Sure.
You touch on so many stories in your book, and you really are very open. And while I don't think Christy and I could say what type of surgeon you are, you certainly, through your book, clearly seek to empower patients. Is that what you really ultimately hope when people read this, that they have a better overall experience with healthcare? Is what your hope?
That is one hope. That actually is a very big hope. I've been in practice 20 years. I've had my share of complications, but I am still in practice. I have a very busy practice, and there's a reason for that. But my hope is, yes, patients do get more involved in their care, ask more questions, try it, you know, find out more information about who their health care provider is, particularly when it comes to surgery and an operation. It's such an invasive interaction that you have, and I would want to know as much as I can about the person doing the operation.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights and thoughts in the book, Confessions of a Surgeon. Certainly, if you Google, I'm sure you'll come up with it. Good luck with your future work.
Thank you, Dr. Ruggieri.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us for House Calls.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Calls, Christy, on our show, we're going to talk about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can check out our new iPhone app and send it to us that way.
Yeah, well, you can actually go to the iPhone store or even the Android store, and if you put in Your Health Radio,
three
UNC
separate words,
healthcare and family medicine, any combination of those, you'll come to our application and you can start following and listening. Very convenient.
Pretty easy to send us questions, so we want some more today.
Challenging ones.
Today we've got some great ones.
Okay, what's our very first question about diabetes?
A friend of mine has diabetes. Could you explain the difference between the two types?
Well, the two different types. There's type 1 and there's type 2. That's an easy. I know it's a lot more than that, isn't it, though, Christy?
It sure is. I mean, it's confusing to people, but in type 1, people usually don't make insulin. In type 2, it's more of a problem of not being able to use the insulin for energy in your body.
Yeah, and frequently we think of type 1 as affecting people who are younger, and type 2 affecting people who are older. Type 1 people aren't usually necessarily overweight. Type 2, they tend to be overweight. There's a lot of crossover, but that's a pretty straightforward way. And regardless, you need to follow your blood sugars and
your blood
be
pressure.
Managed. And the closer you get your blood sugars down to normal, the healthier you'll be.
It's true. Hopefully that shed some light on it. And we can put some information on our blog as well. Our fantastic librarians at the Health Sciences Library will put something up about just some basics about diabetes.
Yep. A lot of research is happening. We look forward to hearing more questions. Next listener house call question has to do with something that happens to a lot of people around this time of year. They have colds.
It's happening to me right now. Excuse my voice, everyone.
We'll have to figure out if Christy needs this.
I know. So this is about Zicam.
I have recently caught a cold and have considered using Zicam, which is supposed to help you get over it faster. What do you think about the drug? And do you think it will really work?
Well, what they're talking about here is actually a proprietary. It's a branded product that contains zinc. And the question that really comes up is, does this or products that contain zinc really help people with colds?
Well, I was glad to find that there was a recent review of multiple different studies.
A systematic review.
Yes, finding that zinc intake was associated with a reduction in the duration and the severity. So how long a cold lasts and how bad it is if you take it, you know, as soon as you get symptoms of a cold.
And what about any side effects? Do we know anything about side effects of zinc? Because I have heard that there are some, I don't know if it's taste or
it is
gastrointestinal and acid.
You got it. Bad taste, nausea, and problems with like smell. And in fact,
those aren't small necessarily, but maybe it's worth it.
Well, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave like a public health advisory about Zicam and other zinc like products that go into your nose, saying that, you know, they shouldn't. It can really affect your nose.
Yeah, I've heard Zicam goes into the nose.
I think so.
And there's actually I've read some class action lawsuits on the product. So I think it's. You know, it's difference between saying zinc in a supplement or a lozenge for a common cold that probably doesn't have a lot of side effects, may or may not help you, versus potentially this particular branded product that there are people that have described some serious potential adverse effects. So I would be very cautious about this particular product.
I would too.
Okay. Well, we're in agreement. Thank you for your question. And let's talk about the very next house call about another problem, particularly for a lot of us guys who are in our early retirement thinking phase.
What?
Of 51 and going out there and playing sports and getting injured.
Okay.
Let's hear the question.
I'm 55 years old and recently have been having pain in my groin and hip muscles. Do you think stretching and exercise would help, or should I first consult a physical therapist?
Oh, they're older than me, Christy. They're 55.
Oh, gosh. So, you know, pain in your groin and your hip muscles, really common. And if you feel like that is just a soreness because you've gone out and started exercising again or a new routine, then doing some stretching and exercising and sort of just light aerobic walking or moving your body, it sounds to me like that would be a reasonable thing to do, that you wouldn't necessarily have to see a physical therapist first before doing some of those lower risk types of things like walking and stretching.
Yeah, I would also encourage you, it doesn't even have to be a physical therapist. It can be a personal trainer.
Mm-hmm.
It can be anyone that has the knowledge that can really work with you. Sometimes it's one thing to know that you should be doing these stretching exercises. It's another thing to actually start doing them. And if someone really instructs you in them and helps you do them and shows you which ones to do that stretch which muscles, it really could be helpful. So I think there's absolutely no risk here. It's a really good thing to do.
I think so, too. And you could start out doing some low things, and then if you're not better or if you have an injury, make sure to consult somebody who knows what they're talking about.
The good news is the physical therapist would probably get paid for if you have insurance.
Right.
The personal trainer might
probably not.
So, okay,
let's take our last one.
I'm planning a scuba trip, and it's cheaper for me to get a return flight right after I go scuba diving later in the day. But is it safe to me to get on an airplane after scuba diving?
Okay, Adam, you're a scuba diver, right?
Well, I think that's probably an overstatement. I have scuba dived. I enjoyed scuba diving, and it's fun. I'll say that. And also, you have to be aware of the risk of scuba diving. And this listener is sharing with us one of the concerns about if you have problems with decompression sickness or concerns about that, you have to put into when you can fly again because of the changes in pressure can cause some serious problems.
Yeah, and if you fly within 12 hours of scuba diving, if you're just somebody who does a one-time scuba diving that day, that increases your chance for this decompression sickness that can be really dangerous. So the recommendation is to wait 12 hours before flying, after you've gone scuba diving. But if you go multiple times in a day scuba diving, or if you go so deep that you have to come up for like a decompression stop.
Right. So that example, that is when my wife and I on our honeymoon went scuba diving and we went down 100 feet. Well, you had to stop every 20 or 30 feet coming up for a minute to avoid any decompression sickness by coming up. On the other hand, if you just go down 10 feet, which the majority of great scuba diving, you can see 6, 8, 10
That's
feet
my
down.
Kind.
You know, it's like going down to the bottom of the pool.
Right.
You know, you hear your ears pop, but there's really no risk there. So,
but in the case, I hope that you and your wife waited. In the case that you go so deep that you have to do these decompression stops, you're supposed to wait 48 hours before flying.
You know,
I mean, that's a general expert recommendation.
I can
anyway.
Tell you she's never going down to 100 feet again after she said, "What is that over there?" And we came back up and I said, "Oh, that was a barracuda."
Oh, wow.
Well, Christy, that concludes our house calls today. We've had some wonderful questions. And thank you for all of our listeners for your questions. And feel free to send us your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our new health app.
And don't forget about our blog, just yourhealthradio.org, and we'll point you to all those other options there as well.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.